now for your feature presentation.
Just one, or two, or three, or four, but five, of course, five.
What's up, list nerds? I am your host, ex-video store clerk, screenwriter, and fellow list nerd Jason Kleberg, and this is Force 5, a show where I force my guests to come up with a movie-themed top 5 list topic, and then we reveal our picks on air. The guest for today's episode is Will Gilby, a writer, director, and editor whose newest film, Jericho Ridge, is available to stream now, and I highly recommend that you do that. It can be tough lining up schedules for people recording overseas, but somehow we made it work, and I'm so happy we did because Will was so much fun to talk to. He's honestly the kind of guy I just love to talk movies with for hours on end. The topic he chose, top 5 badass female protagonists, was a hefty one, but I think we had a great mix of obvious picks and some deeper cuts so you can both celebrate iconic queens of cinema and hopefully discover some new ones. Please, welcome Will Gilby to the Force 5 podcast. Welcome back to the Force 5 podcast. Earlier this year, I was watching the Action Movie Year in Review by Kinemotions on YouTube. I've mentioned this video many times because I've found several really good action films from his recap. And in that video, he mentioned a film called Jericho Ridge, going so far as to say it was one of his favorite films of 2023. So I had to seek it out. I signed up for BET Plus, which is the only place that it's playing here in the United States, for a free trial. It was maybe 10 minutes after I saw the end credits. I sent a message to the writer-director Will Gilby to see if he would consider being on the show because I love this movie so much. And I'm lucky to have Will on with me today. Will, how are you this morning? Well, I guess evening for you.
Late afternoon, but I just want to say, Jason, thank you so much for having us on. Obviously, so chuffed that you like the film. And, you know, just any way to get the word out about this, which is obviously quite a, you know, it's a smaller budget film. We're actually just about to start coming out around the world a little bit more. We're coming out in England in April and sort of some other territories as well. We're coming out in France. But we might have just come out and streaming in France, Germany, South America, Australia. So, you know, it's going to hopefully start getting out there a little bit more and not being this sort of incredibly hard to find curio that literally some of the sort of gnarliest action heads on Twitter seem to have been the guys that have gravitated towards it and found it. And then sort of, yeah, like yourself, people have sort of followed their lead, really. And that's how they found it. But anyway.
Yeah, it's word of mouth.
Thanks for having me, basically.
For those who don't know where you're at, where are you located?
I live in South London. Obviously this film was not shot in London. It was shot in Kosovo. I don't know if you knew. Did you know anything about the production of this? Or
I did not. I actually didn't even know that the lead actress was not American because she put on such a great accent.
I mean, the whole cast wasn't American. So they're all it's an English cast doing American accents, which I think is probably the easier way around than doing the American cast doing English accents, which sure. You know, is, you know, probably a bit harder. I mean, you know, in England, it's, if you want to be a working actor and you want to work regularly, you've got to have a pretty good American accent in your back pocket. Otherwise, you know, it's going to be pretty tough.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Will, you come from a family of filmmaking of sorts. Your brother, Julian, is also a director. How did you guys get into the movie business?
I think it was just years ago being super inspired. My brother was always obsessed with Jaws, and then that just translated into making Jaws 5. It was unofficial. I don't think we had the rights. When he was about 13, I was about 9, I think. We went to Portugal with a wooden fin and made that. And then it was always just running around the woods, you know, all the stuff we were sort of making and running around doing got just sort of progressively more action orientated. There's a lot of fake guns in the woods. There's a lot of, you know, bangers with condoms full of fake blood strapped to our friends. There's a lot of times people called the police because, so that's sort of where it started, really. And then I started out working with Jules, my brother, and we did a couple of films together. And then, you know, trying to get films off the ground is, it's just incredibly hard to find finance and stuff like that. So I figured out I need to find myself a day job. And I sort of transitioned into editing mostly and was just, I've been doing that on and off for the last however many years. Just got a screenwriting, but mostly editing and just looking for an opportunity to make my own film. You know, I've done a lot of first time film directors, first features, I've cut them, you know, varying degrees of success. Some have worked out brilliantly, some didn't maybe missed the mark. You know, I'm not going to say which is which, obviously, because I'm not a dick. Yeah. I don't know if I could. Can I swear? I'm not going to swear a lot. But,
yeah, we're good. We're
okay,
good.
Great. But so just, you know, that's kind of it. I've been trying to get a film off the ground as a director for some time, and I had another script, which I really want to make. It's a really cool, twisty, turny crime thriller. It's really exciting. But I think it was a bit more expansive. It was a bit more sprawling. And this sort of, the purity of the idea, just sort of mostly one location, action, and, you know, a protagonist just being put through the ringer in this insane pressure cooker. Sort of as soon as I'd written it, it was just a sort of much more welcoming reception from sort of low budget financiers, people who are going to take a gamble on a first-time filmmaker.
Sure, single location films can certainly do that.
Yeah.
And I don't want to steal the thunder of what Jericho Ridge is about. For those who may not have heard of it before, how would you sell somebody on it? What's it about, and why is it cool?
Well, I guess everyone's saying it's like a police siege thriller. It's about a mother of a teenage son being called in to work dispatch radio for a night. She's called in. She's got a broken ankle, so she shouldn't really be working. While the rest of the deputies and the sheriff go off to deal with another case, she's sort of left there on her own with her son. And then stuff starts to obviously go wrong, and it sort of ends up, the sheriff's office sort of ends up getting attacked. And the sort of latter part of the film is basically a siege where she's fighting for her life and fighting to keep her son alive, and it's super intense. And, you know, that's my sort of elevator pitch, or as good as it's going to get, yeah.
Obviously, when you have a police-set siege film, you're going to have comparisons to Assault on Precinct 13. You're going to have comparisons to, like, Rio Bravo, I guess, in a lesser sense. What other films were you influenced by when it came to Jericho Ridge?
Well, I mean, those are the interesting ones, because a lot of people have obviously said Assault on Precinct 13. Obviously, like, mm-hmm. I'm sure you are, and most people listening to this, I'm a massive John Carpenter fan. Like, how can you not be if you're into genre cinema?
Yep.
But it's one of those things where I came up with the idea. I was like, okay, it's a sheriff's deputy manning a dispatch radio, and that's all I had initially. And then I was like, people start to, you know, it kicks off. And then I thought, oh, Christ, we're stepping a little bit close to Assault on Precinct 13. So I haven't watched it for a long time, and I deliberately didn't watch it while I was developing this, because I didn't want to sort of, you know, subconsciously be drawing stuff from it. But then, like you said, like Assault on Precinct 13 is a sort of loose reimagining of Rio Bravo, down to the point that, you know, Carpenter actually does a commentary on the Rio Bravo disc. You know,
I forgot about that.
Yeah, he does. So he's still like, we could, and also it's 1976, so I think the world's ready again for another police siege thriller. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, yeah. They're big shoes to fill, and obviously it's a massive, you know, inspiration. But I guess, like, inspirations are pretty wide, really. You know, I'm a massive James Cameron. I think no one really does action much better than James Cameron. Obviously, he does it on a superhuman scale, but his action's always very rooted in emotion, very rooted in character. You completely understand the geography, and you can, you know, like a lot of films, I think we're sort of coming out of the era of sort of over-editing and stuff like that. We certainly are, but you can see what the heck's going on. And I think that's really impossible sometimes to make the shots a bit simpler and enjoy the moment and sit in it, rather than just sort of let your camera going absolutely bananas and trying to sort of cover up what you can't. But, you know, I've edited films where they're trying to do an action scene and it didn't really work out, and you have to go for that style, because otherwise you're stuck. So I think it's usually, yeah. But then when that style becomes like the driving force in the industry for, I don't know how many years it was, but it was a pretty miserable time for action films.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. I don't think anyone's, nostalgic for that, are they?
No. You know, my most recent screenplay is a siege film too. And
nice.
I've spent many showers standing there under the water, just like wondering what it was that was missing. Cause I knew I was missing something. And when I watched Jericho Ridge, I kind of instantly knew what I was missing, because your screenplay does something really special in that within the first 15 minutes, you've set up all these small domino pieces for the audience in a really smart, really lean way. And then about 15, 20 minutes in, you just kind of push that first domino. And then you let the audience just watch the rest of the setups pay off for like an hour straight. It really did remind me of my favorite screenplay of all time, which is Die Hard.
Wow.
And it's something that isn't done right a whole lot. But I tell you what, dude, it was literally a spark to me to get back to my rewrite, because it's just amazing the way that you did that.
That's awesome. I really appreciate it. Well, I'm a massive fan, you know, of I sort of came of, you know, I started becoming obsessed with films in the 90s. And obviously Shane Black, you know, was a massive titan for you know, for all people wanting to write sort of action orientated genre films. And he's so good at setups and payoffs. And you get such a, and I just, I do love those moments when I'm watching a film where you're like, oh Christ. I mean, my biggest one I had in the cinema was Toy Story 3. I don't even remember the end of that. They're all together. They're going down the thing into the trash compactor. And I was like, I was putting my filmmaker's head on, trying to write my way out of the situation and thinking, nope. And I was thinking, oh my God, they're going to kill Woody. They're going to kill Buzz. Slinky Dog's toast. And then the claw, spoilers, apologies if you haven't seen it. The claw comes down and you slap your forehead and just go, that's great. So if we can get even one tenth of that in this film, and hopefully there are a couple of moments that maybe edge that, then I'm super happy. But yeah, it was, you know, that first 20, it was always a case of trying to keep it as compressed as possible that the audience aren't going to get, you know, tired of the build. And then once it starts, it doesn't really stop, which is cool.
Yeah, it's like it's just small things. But in your mind, you're like, OK, that's coming in. And there's, you know, there's a bunch of things that you know are gonna you're gonna roll through, and it's just so much fun to watch it unfold.
It's a really satisfying thing when you're writing something and you're just like you're writing, you're like, oh, okay. Or you figure it out later on and then you go back and seed it and you try and bury it as sort of, you know, as cleverly as, or you know, try and bury it as deep as you can, just so people sort of acknowledge it, forget about it, and then bang, you hit them over the head with it.
Switching gears real quick before we get into our list today, I think it's important to kind of get a sense of your overall film taste. So what are some of your favorite films of all time?
Well, yeah, I'm going to do my, I think this is my top five. And I sort of, I guess this is like, you know, not, I don't think these are the best films ever made, but they're my favorites. Right. And I reckon if I went to a desert island and I had these, if someone managed to hook me up with a decent OLED on the desert island, big one with a good 4K Blu-ray player and a nice surround setup, I think I'm going to have to say, and obviously this is sort of, you know, dependent on what mood you're in and which way the wind's blowing, but I think if I have to do a top five, I'm going to go The Wild Bunch, Goodfellas, Aliens, Fargo, and La Haine. I just found all of these, like most of these I watched sort of when it, maybe 16, 17, 18, that sort of age when you're really becoming obsessed and then you watch something and it just buries itself in your brain. And I also find those films that literally every time you watch them, and I rewatched them, you know, quite, you know, they all keep coming. I bought them all a horrendous amount of time on every format, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I've bought the VHS, I've bought the widescreen VHS, I've bought the DVD, the special edition DVD, the Blu-ray, the special edition, and the 4K Blu-ray. And it's, you know, my wife thinks I'm insane, but I accrue a lot of value for it. But these ones, I feel you can learn something every time you watch, every time you put Goodfellas on. I feel like you can watch it once a week for the rest of your life. And as a filmmaker, as a writer, as you can learn something about the process. There's just so much brilliant filmmaking and talent on display, you know. And then Sam Peckinpah is huge for me. I sort of there's that great biography of him, If They Move, Kill 'Em, is it called? I haven't read it for like 20 years, but it's fantastic.
Oh yeah.
And then James Cameron, I mean, you know, Aliens for me, you know, I love Alien, but Aliens is the one I just adore. And yeah, Fargo, La Haine, I just, yeah, what can you say?
But hey, I got to rewatch that. I haven't seen that for like 20 plus years.
It's really good. And the director, Matthew Kasovitz, it's, you know, it's by far his best film. He sort of seems to have segued more into acting these days. But, you know, it's one of those wild things when you're doing your first film. You look at those people who just came out and just had pure genius straight out of the gate. And it really is kind of haughty, but it makes you feel like, oh, you know, it's quite a hard thing to deal, you know, cope with when people are that good that quick. Most people, they do a film, they do another film, and you're sort of learning and improving. But there's some people just came out swinging, and it's very intimidating, but, you know, it's very inspiring too.
Great Vincent Cassell role in that one.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
All right. Well, on your top five films list, you had some films with some badass female protagonists. And it's no secret why we landed on the topic we did. Jericho Ridge's protagonist, Tabby Temple, played just amazingly by Nikki Amuka-Bird, is about as badass as it gets. There are a ton of great female protagonists. One of my goals with my list today was to shine a light on some badasses that might not get a ton of love from today's audiences, or those people that you might not see on like a top five list online. So I based those around the traits of some of those Mount Rushmore badasses.
Yeah, I've chosen a couple of the obvious ones just because they were really the ones that that's really inspired me, you know. So I might have gone for a couple of obvious ones, but hopefully there's a couple.
Well, I'm going to cover some deeper cuts here.
Nice.
Will Gilby, you ready to get into our list today?
Very much so. Let's do it.
You know what's going to happen? You know what's happening right now? How you know what's going to happen?
No.
Words? You just made the list.
All right, number five. So you mentioned Fargo in your top five movies of all time. I think there's something really cool about like a female special agent, a female FBI agent. Clarice Starling's another one that comes to mind from Silence of the Lambs. But I went with somebody that is a little bit less well known. I went with the main character from the 2023 film To Catch a Killer. Her name's Eleanor, played by Shailene Woodley. Is this a film that you're familiar with?
No, I haven't seen it. To Catch a Killer.
We have an Olympic class marksman running wild. Every shot found its mark.
305 West Edge.
No casings, no brass, not a single fingerprint.
Start recording. Every face on video. Get him on your phone.
He didn't come here to die. And he does not want to be found. We're going to disappoint him.
These people, they're just born playing evil.
Evil is cutting off a bird's wing just to see what happens. This guy is swatting mosquitoes.
Why'd you say that thing about mosquitoes?
I don't think he's looking for destruction. I think he's looking for relief.
What's your name?
Eleanor Falco, sir.
What's your name?
I'd have to ask for your transfer.
I'd be working for the Bureau.
You were rejected by the Bureau. It was your psycho val that did you in. Aggressive, addictive, antisocial. This is the profile of people we arrest, not hire. I think you got talent. I need you to use it as fuel to bring me something new.
Yeah, and look, I'm going to tell you right off the bat, it's a terrible title. I think that the title kind of made this film get buried and made it seem like direct-to-video fare. But I tell you what, it's a banger movie. Eleanor is a Baltimore police officer, and in the very first scene, she's called into action when a mass shooter starts picking people off on New Year's Eve with a sniper rifle. It's an amazing, harrowing scene, especially here in America, where you have to worry about that shit every day.
Yes.
But from moment one, there's these really small things that make you aware of how smart she is. Like there's an explosion in this apartment building where the killer is suspected to be hiding, and she runs towards the apartment building. But as she does it, she pulls her phone out and she starts recording everybody leaving just to make sure that if the killer leaves, she's got him on record there.
Nice.
And her intellect like really quickly catches the attention of the Special Agent Landmark, who's played by Ben Mendelsohn from the FBI. And he recruits her onto the task force to find the killer based on how she profiles the killer, because she's doing it in a totally different way than everyone else seems to do it. And it's just a film about her using her smarts and good old-fashioned police work to follow leads. And there's no way that they would have caught this person without her, or know the identity of this person without her. And there's just a certain tact to everything she does. You notice it in every scene. There's a scene where she's trying to get innocent people out of a drugstore before shit goes down. And the way that she does it is really, really smart. She's certainly a flawed character, much like Clarice from Silence of the Lambs, but she's using that role in the police force in order to overcome those personal demons.
Yeah.
I tell you what, if you like the police procedurals from the 90s,
yeah,
I mean, who doesn't, right? They're right, amazing. Yeah. This is a worthy addition. And
I can't get enough. I can't get enough of the cops. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I had mentioned this film in my honorable mentions when we did our top five films of 2023, and I really think this is a strong film. So I would highly recommend To Catch a Killer from 2023, and Eleanor from that movie is my number five.
Well, that's great, because I can, you know, this is homework as well, so I can go and watch that tonight, and that's awesome. You know, I always find that finding anything new is fantastic. I'm gonna go with my number five, the 1996. I'm gonna call it a classic. I bloody love it. Is The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Oh, yeah.
We have 24 hours. We find her and we kill her.
Rolling Stone says Long Kiss is super sexy and action-charged. It juggles jolts and jokes with a mad fervor. Turns on the fireworks.
Hey, honey, this is a real big gun.
This ain't no ham or rat, pal.
Gina Davis and Samuel L. Jackson are the action team of the fall.
Honk if there's any trouble.
Yeah, so Miss Daisy, I be honking.
What a ride. Take it.
The Long Kiss Goodnight, rated R, starts Friday at a theater near you.
With one of the, you know, she's amazing in it, and it's you know, I think I read an article saying it's Samuel L. Jackson's all-time favorite character that he's ever played. I think it was Rennie Harlan's sort of, I think it's his best film. Yeah, I think Gina Davis, I don't know, it just felt like, it sort of came out in 1996, I must have been, what, 17, and just seeing that in the cinema, and again, Shane Black, I was so obsessed with The Last Boy Scout, mm-hmm. so obsessed with Lethal Weapon, and you know, they were just really playing up in the papers, weren't they, about how much these specs he was writing were selling for. I think this one sold for $4 million, which is just...
Jesus Christ.
Incredible. But I just think it's a really... really fun film. I don't think it takes itself particularly seriously. I think I actually think it's some of Rennie Harlan's best. That and Cliffhanger are by far his best action films, I think, in terms of actual staging of the action sequences. He's got a really nice... he'll always throw a wide geography shot into every action sequence just so you know where the hell everyone is. You know, he does a really nice one actually in Die Hard 2 when they're on the wing. It must have, just he just goes wide at one point and you just get it. You know, a lot of people don't do that, and it's just a lot of heads shooting at heads, arm, you know. So I don't know. I just think she's an amazing character. I love her sort of I love that, you know, that change from Samantha Cain to Charlie Baltimore. Is it Craig Bierko is the villain? He's just cooking, having so much. He's having the time of his life. You got Samuel L. Jackson. And yeah, it's kind of massively over the top. Borderline ridiculous, but just cool. And she looks so iconic when she trims and has that short blonde hair, and she's futzing around on ice skates, shooting people. And I'm just like, it's really fun. It's a good time, and it's fun. And Brian Cox as well, isn't he? David Morse.
Oh yeah.
I just remember there's a couple of lines in that that just, you know, when you're in the cinema and you start laughing and you're like, for 5 minutes, you're like, okay, I can't. I've got to stop. I'm that guy. I'm annoying everyone now. But it's very funny. Shane Black writes, you know, great, great dialogue. And I think what a great double act, you know, Gina Davis, Samuel L. Jackson. I mean, it's, you know, those guys. Yeah. Couple sequels would have been nice, actually. Turn that into a franchise. Christ.
I know. That would have been so much fun. This could have made so many top five lists, like top five explosions, the bridge explosion at the end. It's like, holy
amazing.
Shit.
Yeah. Don't hit the cars.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
Top five torture scenes. That water wheel
scene, my God,
is like,
superb.
It always sticks in my brain.
Yeah, it's a really good one. Yeah, just I just think it's, you know, it's just a really cool, really fun action movie. I'm a massive fan. I think it's shot, and it's actually really nicely shot. Some really nice long lens photography. I think it's Guillermo Navarro who did it, who used to shoot Guillermo del Toro's films, and he shot a couple of Rodriguez films. He's sort of, I think he shot Jackie Brown. Unless I'm going mad, I could be wrong on that, but so there's some really nice photography in it, and it's just kind of crazy, completely over the top, nutty fun.
Well, I'm glad this is on your list, because this is on my honorable mentions list.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, she's super badass. What's the line? Chefs do that.
Yes. Yeah. Where she's chopping everything and then she throws up the orange or the whatever and just throws a knife straight through it. It's awesome.
Oh, so good. All right, number four for me. I feel like it's a little bit blasphemous to have a list like this without the most obvious badass female martial artist represented in Michelle Yeoh.
Oh, yeah.
I could have gone with Crouching Tiger. I could have gone with Everything Everywhere All at Once, the Heroic Trio. But I'm not going to go with Michelle Yeoh. I think everybody is aware of Michelle Yeoh. I'm going to go with a less in the zeitgeist pick for my number four here with one of my favorite female martial artists who is finally getting her due these days because of some really good boutique label Blu-ray releases. And that's nice. Cynthia Rothrock. And I'm going to go with her amazing 1990 film that more people need to see, China O'Brien.
There are some places in this world.
I can't see you back there.
Where a pretty girl should never walk alone.
But I can feel you.
Unless her name is China O'Brien.
She's one of them chop suey fighters.
Once, she was a big city cop.
Reconsider.
Now, she's on her own, heading for the most dangerous place of all. The place she once called home.
China!
Dad!
He's
some changes around town since you've gone, China.
I'll never touch a gun again.
Where she learned to love. Where she learned to fight. Where she watched them kill her father.
Are you familiar with the China O'Brien films?
I am, absolutely. I mean, the last time I watched that would have been VHS.
Yeah.
So we're going back to 1999, 8. I would have probably last seen that. But yeah, it was just her birthday. I think on Twitter, everyone's been posting loads of clips of her recently because I think it's just been her birthday. But yeah, to go out there, to Hong Kong and do it with all those, to mix it up with that to those stunt teams and stuff like that, you've got to be pretty serious and pretty capable and super physical. And yeah, she's absolutely badass.
Oh, she's great. In China O'Brien, she plays a big city cop, and she's also the martial arts trainer for other officers, of course. And then during one of the sting operations, a kid is killed under her watch, and so she turns in her badge. She vows never to pick up a gun again, and she moves back to her small town where her dad is the sheriff in I think it's Utah, where she goes. And of course, some shit goes down there where organized crime has moved in and they're pushing dope. And because her father's in the way, he gets killed. So she decides to both run for sheriff and clean up the town with her fists and her feet.
And feet, yes.
And nice. Man, her kicks, holy shit. I love the way Cynthia Rothrock fights.
Yeah.
And it's nice seeing her not play the sidekick, because in a lot of her Hong Kong movies, she does play, she's badass, but she plays the sidekick to some dude.
Of course.
And in this one, she's like the real main character. I mean, her name is the title. If you want a really great scene on YouTube to check on China O'Brien, there's a gym fight that is on YouTube in it. She just starts beating up a gang of dudes using the gym equipment to her advantage. It's really, really fun. You see how quick she moves. China O'Brien, like you said, VHS, it was a video store like straight to Blockbuster movie back then.
Totally.
And it was a video store success. There was a sequel later that same year, China O'Brien 2. And in that one, a gangster comes to her town to hide out. But there's a new sheriff in town and she takes care of him. China O'Brien's getting released both 1 and 2 by Vinegar Syndrome coming up here soon, which is amazing. So,
oh, really? Are they doing a 4K, do you know? Or
I don't know if it's 4K.
Well, I'll pick that up anyway. That sounds awesome.
I really want more people to pay more attention to Cynthia Rothrock. I mean, action fans like us are aware of her, but I think a lot of her films kind of go under the radar. And Vinegar Syndrome's done a great job the last couple of years. They put out
Super.
Sworn to Justice, Undefeatable, Righting Wrongs, the martial law films. If I want to sell you one more time on Cynthia Rothrock, if you've ever played Mortal Kombat, Sonya Blade from Mortal Kombat was modeled after Cynthia Rothrock. So there you go. China O'Brien is my number 4.
Okay, that's a great pick. I do. I just, my eldest brother back in the 90s, he went through a martial arts obsessive phase. And obviously I was quite young and he was able to go and rent them all out. And so I just had a really good education of watching, a lot of people get kicked in the face in the early 90s. Yeah. It was great. You know what I mean?
Yeah, she's so fast. She just like, man, she rips.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, my number 4 I'm going to go with, and I think I can say protagonist, because I think there's dual protagonists in this film. I'm going to go with Karen Sisko in Out of Sight, 1998. Steven Soderbergh's adaptation of the Elmore Leonard novel.
The New York Times. The Los Angeles Times. Newsweek. People all across the country, the reviews are out of sight.
I get that feeling, yeah.
The sexiest movie of the summer.
Let's get out of here.
Cool, hip, and hilarious.
Nice house.
Thank you. Clooney and Lopez give it steam heat.
Oh, man.
Stylish and entertaining.
Now you're talking, brother.
One of the year's best. Out of Sight. Rated R.
I think it's an absolute banger of a film. I absolutely love it. I think as far as Elmore Leonard, I'm obsessed with Elmore Leonard. I must have read 30 plus of his books. And I think out of all the adaptations, film, TV, I think it's a toss up probably between Out of Sight and Jackie Brown. And I think for me, I think Out of Sight, just because it's a bit tighter, maybe a bit more focused, it just edges it for me. I also think it's Jennifer Lopez's, to my money, my favorite performance she's ever done. I did really like Hustlers quite recently. I thought that was a real return to form for her. But I remember thinking, I saw this in the cinema, and she is such a cool character. And that romance that plays out, And your first image of her just pulling out a shotgun and just going to, you know, just when she goes to the prison and there's a breakout and she just literally whips a shotgun straight out of the trunk of her car. And you're like, and then there's a great performance by Dennis Farina as her dad. That's another great relationship. He's, you know, I loved him. I just think it's a really, really cool character. I think they actually did a spin-off series just about Karen Sisko with who was the lead in, you know, it's going to come to me. But they did a spin-off series, which didn't take off because I think the character was so, you know, cool. The book's great. And yeah, just love it.
Man, out of sight. I haven't seen that in a long time. I think it's probably been since theaters. And I have it on my shelf. I bought the Kino Blu-ray and I just haven't watched it yet.
They've done a 4K release in about the last 6 to 12 months. But yeah, it's always been a really big one for me. Just really cool, really nice, you know, really nice different visual differentiation between sort of all the different locations. Detroit looks so different to Florida looks. And it was really Steven Soderbergh's sort of, I guess, his comeback film after a few years in the wilderness.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, you know, a super charming George Clooney performance. And I don't, you know, I can't remember if it was a hit or not. It was definitely a critical hit. I'm not sure about box office. But yeah, it was a really cool one.
That's a great choice.
Yeah, big fan.
I'm putting that on my rewatch list here.
Yeah, you've got to. That's one of the films I must have watched 20, 30 times. Just love it.
Hey, listeners, just jumping in here for a word from today's sponsor, Slot Swamp Casino. Everyone knows what a great time Slot Swamp Casino is, but it just got greater because Slot Swamp Casino just got 50% bigger, which makes it 50% better. Now featuring more tables, more room, more everything. And now you can enjoy the songs of Rock Hard Rod and his show Jizz Jams while you play. Hey, bigger is better. Slot Swamp Casino. Let them know the Force 5 podcast sent you for free tickets to Rock Hard Rod's Jizz Jams. And now, back to the show. Number three for me, we could have probably done a whole list of Disney protagonists for strong females because there's a ton. Long history of badass female protagonists. Merida from Brave, Elsa, Elastigirl, who's, you know, a superhero with three kids. There's a ton that we could have done here. But I'm going to go with who I think is the strongest overall, and that is Mulan from 1998.
From Walt Disney Home Video comes the story of a young girl who found the courage to risk everything for the honor of her family.
It's going to take a miracle to get me into the army.
Did I hear someone ask for a miracle?
My ancestor sent a little lizard to help me.
Dragon, not lizard. I don't do that tongue thing.
We're under attack!
I've got an idea.
Who are you?
Your worst nightmare.
Disney's Mulan.
You the man. Well, sort of.
Coming to video February 2nd, 1999.
If you've never seen Mulan, I'm talking about obviously the animated version.
Oh, yes.
I have not seen the remake. I've kind of banned all Disney remakes. But this is a story of a young Chinese maiden who is trying to marry her away, and she keeps kind of messing up those meetings, and she learns that her weakened father is going to be called into the army in order to fight the invading Huns because they take the strongest male and there are no other males in her family. And knowing that he would never survive the rigors of war, she decides to cut her hair and go into disguise, and she joins the army in his place. And unknown to her, her ancestors are aware of this. They try to prevent it. They have a tiny disgraced dragon named Mushu that joins her to try and get her to abandon her plan, but he soon learns that Mulan will not be dissuaded and instead decides to help her out. You talk about a kick-ass female. I'll make a man out of you. You know, she basically shows them.
Kids love that.
Yeah, how unimportant it is to be a man when you're using brains and the talents that you got. Mulan teaches us about family. She teaches us about honor, and most importantly, I think for kids, it teaches us that whatever men can do, women can do, and honestly, they could probably do it better. And there's no better scene to show this off than the training montage in Mulan, where the final challenge is retrieving an arrow at the very top of this very tall pillar. And all these guys try it once and they give up, and you see Mulan working at it all night long. And as the sun comes up and people are coming out of their tents, she tosses the arrow down to the ground as she's sitting on top of that thing. one of those tear-inducing moments of the movie. It's got, epic animated battle scenes. I don't know how long it's been since you've seen Mulan, but that battle scene where the Huns...
I haven't watched it for a while, but I must have watched it with my kids about 5 years ago, maybe. But yeah, it's very good.
All those horses coming over the hill. It's like, holy shit, it looked great.
Yeah.
And then you got that avalanche coming down. I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan, and it was like, whoa, Battle of the Bastards. I could see some influence right here on Battle of the Bastards.
I bet.
It's got a fantastic score. It's got a great soundtrack, and I'll Make a Man Out of You is one of those classic Disney songs. I think if I was ever to do top five.
It's a top tier Disney song, isn't it? Yeah, if you're going to do five songs, it's definitely in them, isn't it?
So good, so good. So yeah, Mulan is my number three from a wide swath of Disney protagonists.
Yeah. Fantastic. I think next up, I'm going to go. I'm pretty buried in the 90s. Like I said, that was the year I really. Also, I just looking at the world now, it seems like to my mind, and I could be wrong, but this is just my opinion. It seems like the 70s and the 90s were just incredible decades for films and music. But like I look back, like I keep watching stuff, rewatching sort of recently stuff. I'm buying it on 4K and rewatching it. Like old 90s films that when I watch at the time, I'm like, huh, yeah, that's all right. Like Ronin or The Fugitive. And I'm rewatching it now just thinking these films are incredible.
Yeah.
They're so well put together. They're so sort of, you know, practical. And I don't know, watching Ronin and just watching Robert De Niro being driven through Paris or small towns in France at like 90 miles an hour. You're like, yeah, that looks incredible. There's a reason that does.
Yep.
But I think my next one, so yeah, we're going to live in the 90s for a moment. I'm going to go with a film I already mentioned, which is Fargo and Marge Gunderson, the Coen Brothers 1996 classic.
Okay, we got a shooting.
A story so strange.
There's a high-speed pursuit.
It's got to be fiction.
And then this execution type deal.
A place so real.
You were having sex with a little fella then.
Yeah.
It's got to be true.
Oh, yeah.
A brilliant macabre thriller so utterly original. It could only be Fargo.
Police!
From the creators of Raising Arizona, there won't be a better film this year. Fargo, rated R.
Which is, you know, it was after the Hudsucker Proxy, wasn't it? Which is so sort of busy and chaotic and sort of visually intense. And then to do this really pared back, I don't want to say simple story because it's not. It's brilliant. It's so twisty and turny. And she's the other fascinating thing. I don't think you meet her till about 35 minutes into the film. I don't think she comes in. I think supposedly the legend is, as Fargo starts with a... all the events in this film are true and this actually happened in Minnesota, blah, blah, blah. Names have been changed. Supposedly that was just their way of getting around. Oh shit. People are going to complain that we introduced our protagonist too late. So, oh, no, it's a true story. You know, let's do it that way. But she's an incredible character. You know, everyone sort of underestimates her. She's super smart. You know, you see her at the end. I remember one of the most tense I've ever felt in a cinema is sort of watching her sneaking up on Peter Stormare at the wood chipper at the end and just thinking, she's going to get, this guy's a psycho. I've seen him. She's going to get, you know, absolutely killed and destroyed. And she pulls the tiniest little revolver I've ever seen, like some old 38 or something, and, you know, deals with it. And then I just think she's such a brilliantly moral character. The incredible relationship with her husband, Norm, is so good. And then obviously you've got, you know, Peter Stormare and Steve Buscemi.
Oh, yeah.
It's just such an amazing sort of pair of criminals. And obviously William H. Macy. I mean, it's just a really cool film. And it's a film I've probably watched as many times as almost anything else in my life. I watched it at such a formative moment. And it really, I think it's my favorite Coen Brothers film.
Mine too.
Is it? And yep. It's beautifully shot by Roger Deakins, but it's quite visually restrained. And also quite similar to what we've got in Jericho Ridge, they were chasing snow the whole shoot. I think they had a nightmare like we had a load of snow, which then melted. So we were like, oh, shit. Well, if we had the snow, and everyone's like, nah, that's never going to melt. You're going to be fine. It's pretty cold. And then it all melted. So we had to figure out ways to shoot around there. We had to figure out how to paint in snow. Now, obviously, it's just a lot easier to paint snow in probably than it was back then. And it is, you know, completely invisible and it can be done, you know, totally brilliantly. But yeah, I think she's such a great character. And, you know, I just picked that up again. They've just released it on 4K not that long ago. And it looks absolutely beautiful. And I'm a huge Roger Deakins fan and, you know, love the Coens. And she won the Oscar for it. I think it was her first. She's won three now. Is that correct? Yeah.
Yeah, she won for Nomadland and...
And Three Billboards. So yeah, she is incredible. She's a force of nature, and I love Marge. Everyone, underestimates her, and she just comes in. She's super smart. She's tenacious, and she gets it done.
Yeah, one of the things I really love, well, there's two things that I want to mention. The first thing that I really love about this movie and her character is that she's pregnant, and
yes.
It's never used as a gimmick in the movie. It's just she's just pregnant. And, when you watch a movie like this, you figure, oh, they made this character pregnant so they could use it later. But it's just a trait that's there.
Yes.
It does add a sense of additional dread, like another layer on top of it.
Oh, totally. Yeah. When you're thinking, like I said, that Peter Stormare moment, when you're thinking mm-hmm. there's a pregnant woman walking towards this psychopath that we've just seen chop up his partner with an axe and who is now putting one of the best fake legs I've ever seen in cinema into a wood chipper. There's that
yep.
one. Is it a leg or a hand in Jaws? I'm trying to remember, but that always had an amazing fake leg.
Oh
one
yeah.
Hand. But that, but yeah. And you think, oh, surely they're not going to go there. But yeah, there's that bit where I think where she bends over having morning sickness.
Oh
like,
yeah.
You okay, Margie? No, just think I'm going to yep. go. And I love the accents as well. I'd never heard a Minnesota accent before.
Of course.
When I first watched that in the 90s and it was just awesome and fascinating, and that sort of that level of politeness, how important to them politeness is. Like I think there's a scene where someone they're sat at a table and someone is like they're talking about murder and stuff, and someone is being slightly impolite, and that like seems to affect them more than anything else that's going on. It's just the fact that people wouldn't be civil to each other, and how obviously repressed everyone is in this part of the world because they're so buttoned up and like, oh yeah.
I mean, it's also so funny how she's got him in the back of the car and she's just kind of lecturing him. He's this
yes.
like stone cold psycho. And she's like, all this for a little bit of money.
I don't get it. I really don't. And it's a beautiful day. And you're just, yeah, it's incredible. And also Carter Burwell's score is just, is really good. Really evocative. And it's one of those great sort of opening shots of the tan Sierra Cutlass. I think you're getting it right. Just coming through the snow, just that sort of bleak. And it's just, yeah, I love it. It's yeah, like I said, it's probably in my top five films of all time.
The one other thing that I'll mention about her character is I had mentioned it with my number five. It's her police skills and the way she thinks. And there's a great scene with her and an old friend, Mike, where
yes.
It's this really awkward scene, but it shows her that like, oh, shit, people can lie. And that's when she goes back to William H. Macy's character.
Yes, exactly. There was this whole internet discourse that the Mike Yanagita scene was just superfluous to the story. I didn't
Not at
really
all.
Pay into it at all, but it is. At the end, she realizes, oh, Mike Yanagita was talking shit, and that inspires her to go back and talk to William H. Macy's character. Oh, maybe he's lying too, and then he flees the interview, and, But yeah, it's a great, it's fantastic. It's super awkward with Mike Yanagita.
That's
yeah,
such a good scene.
But he tries to sit down next to her, doesn't he? And he's just
yeah.
like, no, sit opposite. And then very nicely, I don't want to have to turn my head. As opposed to, don't be a fucking creep, jog on and sit over there.
Such a good scene.
Yeah, it's very good. And her husband just being obsessed about whether or not his painting is going to be on a stamp. And she's dealing with multiple murders, shooting people, and he's just all sensitive and huffy about, and then she has to talk him into, and then he's like, oh yeah, and it's beautiful.
So good.
It's beautiful.
So my number two here, I mean, it could be number one any day of the week, but when you said female protagonists, badass female protagonists, there were three that came to mind right away. They could have been my number one. One of those was the bride from Kill Bill.
Sure.
A real obvious one. Who, if you've never seen Kill Bill, you gotta watch it. I mean, she mows down an entire gangster organization in the first film.
Crazy 88.
Yeah, one of the most amazing action scenes of the 21st century. But, I figured everybody's gonna be familiar with The Bride. Everybody's familiar with Kill Bill. I'm gonna go with somebody who inspired the character for Quentin Tarantino when he was writing it. One of his favorite female martial artists, the actress Angela Mao, often referred to as the female Bruce Lee. And, I probably could have gone with almost any Angela Mao film, but I'm going to go with the movie Hapkido from 1972.
Here comes the lethal lady of Kung Fu. Lady Kung Fu. She's the crack karate queen who really drives men mad. Just watch her go into action. And watch out, for the pigtail that whips you up and wipes you out.
It's about these three Chinese students. Angela Mao is one of them. Sammo Hung, a very young Sammo Hung. Nice. I think he was like 19 or 20 when he makes this movie. And Carter Wong. They return to their village after 5 years of training in Hapkido in Korea. And so they come back, they set up their own dojo. And of course, like a lot of these films go, there's a rival Japanese school, the Black Bear School.
Of course there is.
Yes. And of course, they're not so nice. And so now these three students must fight to protect their school and their village. It's a really simple setup. You can tell that this film was made simply to show off the martial arts skills, these Golden Harvest killers.
Of course.
And it works. Holy shit, it works. It's got a great cast. I mentioned Sammo Hung. I mentioned Carter Wong. It's also got Yuen Biao.
Oh, wow.
It's got a blink and you miss it cameo from Jackie Chan in the background. But Angela Mao straight up steals the show. So much so that when it was released in the United States in a dubbed version for Grindhouse theaters, it was renamed Lady Kung Fu.
Right. Someone wasn't trying with that title, were they?
You know?
Also, it's Hapkido, right?
Yeah,
which is a different martial art. So they're crossing,
So there's a great scene near the end of this movie where they're showing off against the big bads of the Black Bear Clan, and it's two guys about to square off, and Angela Mao jumps into frame, and she just says, "This one's mine. I want to avenge my friend's death." And she goes one-on-one with this dude. She's not untouchable, you know? She's getting smacked around, too. But she shows exactly what she can do. There's a part of it where she just unleashes four straight up spin kicks in a row to some guy's face.
Nice.
She's using her ponytail as a deadly weapon. She ends up choking the guy out using only her ankles. I mean, that's how badass she is. And she has tons of scenes in different movies where she just takes on a gang of dudes. And it's so, so impressive. If you want to watch Angela Mao, Hapkido is a great place to start. Lady Whirlwind is another one.
Nice.
The Tournament, another Sammo Hung movie. Actually, Sammo Hung, I think, was in Lady Whirlwind, too. Man, she was such a kick-ass martial artist. And the female Bruce Lee, like, there's a reason that they dubbed her that, because she was just really, really cool.
Amazing. Yeah.
Going back to video games real quick, a lot of people think that Chun-Li from Street Fighter was inspired by Mao. She played a character named Lee Chun in Lady Whirlwind.
Really?
Yeah, her amazing fast kicks. And, you know, we've been talking a little bit about physical media here. Arrow recently released a double feature with both Hapkido and Lady Whirlwind. If you want to check these out, it's the best way to do it.
I'll order it while we're talking. No, I won't. I'll wait till the end. But I'll be getting that. That sounds awesome. I love Arrow. I think they do some great stuff.
Yeah, so I had to go with Angela Mao for my list at number two.
That's awesome. That's a great choice. I can't wait to see this. So I've got two films here I haven't seen, which I'm going to absolutely have to catch up on. But I love that. It's like you were talking about earlier about the list of films someone made on YouTube. They sort of did a breakdown of 2023's action films. And you watch that and they cover like 30, 40 films. And maybe you're aware of, but you find gems you've never even heard of. And that is just such a joy, I find, you know, just being like, Christ, I've got like the next five nights just stacked with awesome action films. That sounds great. I'm going to go next up. We're going to stay in the 90s for now, okay? This came out in 1999 in England, and I must have been 18, 19, and it blew the back of my head out. And it's Tom Tykwer's Run, Lola, Run, starring Franka Potenta. I think it's such a visually original and just. I think Tom Tykwer was obsessed with video games when he was playing it, so he was doing that. Well, you get three lives in most video games. So my lead character's got three chances to, you know, it's about her boyfriend who has lost some money or some cars for his boss, and he's going to get killed in 20 minutes. He's going to rob a convenience store to pay him back. And Franka Potenta basically just has 20 minutes to get there and rescue him. And she starts running, and then she has three goes at it. And it is just, I remember watching that as a sort of young wannabe filmmaker. And the thing that blew me away as much as anything is the editing. Even now watching it again, it's one of the most creatively edit, and like I was reading up about the editor, is a French editor called Mathilde Bonnefoy, And I think she was only 26 years old, but she'd moved to Berlin, and she was one of the few people in Berlin at the time who knew how to work Avid. And she's, I think, gone on to do like four, five, six films with Tom Tykwer. But it's just some of the most creative, it's the consequences it deals with, where every time sort of Lola runs past like five or six different people, you'll just get these sort of scatter-cutted like Polaroid images of how their lives are affected by crossing her and how it's different each time. But she's, Franka Potenza is so cool. She's that iconic red hair, the green trousers, the DM boots. I think me and my brother made a film years ago called Lonely Place to Die in like 2011. It came out, and we actually initially we cast her, and then the budget fell out, and we got delayed by a year. And then we went with another very talented actress. But she, I think, it was just completely awesome. Super young at the time, by all accounts. Wasn't much of a runner, and then found herself spending, 15 hours a day sprinting, which I can't imagine. I think if you're in your 20s, you can get away with it, maybe. Yeah, nowadays, you put your knee out, you blow an ankle within 5 minutes, film's over, we do it on a green screen. But it is just such a creative use of location, it's cutting from animation, where, to VHS video, literally some of the scenes are in. I don't know, she's just completely iconic. And I went to see that in the cinema on the King's Road, and it blew my, and I literally, and the music, which I think Tom, she sings some of the, Franka Potenza sings on some of the Tom Tykwer, he did some of the tracks. I'm pretty sure I ran most of the way home, just sprinting down the street, just wanting to recapture some of the energy I felt from watching that film. But this is a big one for me. This is one of those ones where, I've bought this film half a dozen times. I've spent a fortune, importing the disc from America, the 4K disc, just because I got to see it in the latest format, see how good it looks. It looks great. But yeah, I probably put this in my top 10, 15 films ever. Just, it's so creative. It's so fun. And it's another lovely thing about it, which sort of Jericho Ridge adjacent, is it's what, 82 minutes, maybe 81 minutes. Jericho Ridge is 87. And I do sometimes, there's definitely like a swollen running times. Obviously it works for some stuff, but for a lot of stuff, maybe it doesn't. And it's just so nice to see something that punchy, that creative, with a character that's that strong, and that, what a silhouette she's got. She's just completely iconic.
I love a good short movie, especially as I get older.
It's 9:30, your kids are going to be up. There's probably going to be screams in the night. I can't do 2.5 hours. Give me 85 minutes. Give me 90 minutes in bed, please. And it's so satisfying. And you watch something and you're like, perfect. Now I can get up and make breakfast for two ungrateful children.
Run Lola Run, man, great choice. This is one of those films that I remember watching back when I worked at the video store. Me and the other employees that worked there would give recommendations back and forth. And we had our little wall of recommendations, and this was on one of my friends' recommendation walls. And I remember taking it home, and I was absolutely blown away because I hadn't seen anything like that. You have your Groundhog's Day type of movies, but this felt so totally different. Movies can be boring when you're playing the same scene out three times in a row, but this was absolutely electrifying. And I think this is another one that deserves a rewatch.
It's also the fact that she learns a bit. She sort of retains some of the information. Like, so the next time she won't make the same mistake or what have you. But it's brilliant. And then in between all the three moments, you have the scenes with her and her boyfriend just lying in bed, smoking with I think it's like beautiful like red light on them and just discussing stuff. And again, the editing, when she just goes, stop, and the music just goes, and their phone receiver is falling down, and they're just into, it's magic. It was so inspiring. And also just at that young age, just felt so beyond my grasp and capabilities in terms of, I think, how well it's put together and how interestingly it's made. But also, I think, Mathilde, the editor, which just blows my mind, she was 26, I think, when she cut it, which is just... I think it's just such a good piece of work. And again, I'm going to say intimidating and inspiring in equal measure. It's one of those things that I want to be that good. I'm not yet. But maybe we'll get there one day.
Sure. Aspirational filmmaking, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah.
Grand finale for me. As I was growing up, there's two baddest ass females of them all. I could have put either one at number one, but I chose to go a different direction. Of course, those are Ripley from one of your favorite films of all time and Sarah Connor from Terminator 2. Like, if I was doing straight up favorite female protagonists, interchangeable, one and two.
Yes.
I wouldn't be able to rank them. But I wanted to show some respect for one of the baddest to ever do it. And if you're a younger listener, you may not be as familiar with the films of Pam Grier. But I'm here to clue you in to her role in Foxy Brown.
When Foxy Brown comes to town, all the brothers gather round, 'cause she can really shake 'em down. Pam Grier, that one chick hit squad who creamed you as coffee, is back to do a job on the mob as Foxy Brown.
Sounds like a public menace.
Show do.
A chick with drive who don't take no jive. She's sweet brown sugar with a touch of spice.
If you see a man anywhere, send him in, because I do need a man.
And murder if you don't treat her nice. Have no fear, Pam Grier is here as Foxy. Foxy Brown. Rated R.
Like Angela Mao, I could have gone with so many roles for Pam Grier, but
yeah,
man, Foxy Brown to me is her at her most ruthless. It's a film about this woman whose boyfriend is killed at her front door, and a little detective work by her leads her to the Catherine Wall Modeling Agency. It's a business that has high-end escorts, but they also dabble in sex trafficking, and they control the local drug syndicate. And so she goes undercover as a prostitute named Misty Cotton in order to take down the organization from the inside, trying to get close to the owners, Elias and Catherine, the couple that runs it all. Holy shit, this movie is amazing. First off, Pam Grier as Foxy Brown looks amazing, has style for days. So many iconic looks in this movie that inspired so many blaxploitation movies that came after it. But all that style that she's got, oh, it's hiding a mean streak. Speaking of hiding, she hides a gun in her afro, which is, yes. I mean, how much more badass does it get than that?
Yeah, that's awesome.
In this movie, she burns people alive. She cuts a dude's dick off and then gives it to his significant other in a pickle jar.
Pretty gnarly.
She's got one of the best, most amazing final lines in cinema history. Death is too easy for you, bitch. I want you to suffer. And I tell you what, I don't do it justice. I'm going to put the clip in there because her delivery of that line is insane.
Go on, shoot! I don't want to live anymore!
I know. That's the idea. The rest of your boyfriend is still around. And I hope you two live a long time. And then maybe you get to feel what I feel. Death is too easy for you, bitch. I want you to suffer.
I haven't watched it in a long time. I haven't watched it since early days of DVD. I'm hoping maybe there's a nice Blu-ray of it these days. Has anyone given it some love?
I'm sure that they have. Yeah, I'm sure that they have.
That's something I need to revisit for sure.
This one was, it was pretty controversial when it came out. It was released as, I think, the second part of a double bill with Truck Turner. And it was chastised for its violence. It was chastised for how it portrayed African-Americans. Because when it came out, it was volatile times. But holy moly, it's been a huge inspiration, highly influential for so many movies that came after it. Obviously, Quentin Tarantino is a huge fan of this movie, but it inspired so many movies through the 70s and early 80s. And in terms of badass female protagonists, shit, for my money, Pam Grier is the baddest of them all. I really encourage people to go check out Foxy Brown. But when you're done with Foxy Brown, check out Coffee.
Yeah.
Check out her women in prison films like The Big Birdcage, Bucktown, Friday Foster. She's got so many bangers out there. And I just love Pam Grier. Wanted to show her some love on this list.
No, I think it's a great choice. Like I said, I haven't watched it in a long time. I'm probably totally due a rewatch. Yeah, great choice. She is completely awe-inspiringly awesome. Yeah, she's brilliant. I've gone for the obvious choice here because, I think all of mine have been 90s so far, so I'm going to slip back to the 80s. But this is a film I've already mentioned, and this is quite an obvious one. But I think it is, I put this in top three, maybe top two of all time. It's 1986, James Cameron's Aliens.
You're going out there to destroy them.
That's the plan.
All right, I'm in.
The first time she survived the most terrifying creature in the universe, she thought the nightmare was over.
Something under the floor.
It hadn't even begun.
It's coming straight for us.
That's inside the room.
Sigourney Weaver, Aliens, the new movie. This time, it's war.
Yeah. Because also this has got two of the baddest female protagonists of all time in Ripley and Vasquez. She is Ripley, and this was such an incredibly exciting, cool. I had this taped off, VHS tape off. You know, when you used to tape it off the TV, and you've got commercials in the middle of it. And then bizarrely, there was a point in my recording where I think my mum or dad must have changed channel, and literally just as they're sort of Spunkmeyer or whatever is going back onto the sort of plane, what do we call it, the drop ship, the alien's just about to snap, and then it just cuts to a picture of it goes and cuts to a goat in a garden for 10 seconds and then comes back. And I was always like, it was also dubbed kind of badly. So instead of sort of, I say we grease this rat fuck son of a bitch now, it was a totally different crappily dubbed voice saying, I say we grease this rat fat son of a bitch. And it was just like, so I loved it. And I watched it before I ever watched Alien. So for me, I've always preferred the original theatrical cut to the special edition, because the special edition kind of obviously gives away the chest burster in the opening, doesn't it? As you know, on LV-426, Newt and her family go there and the dad comes back and he's got the facehugger attached. But I obviously saw this, you know, I didn't know what the hell was going to happen when I first watched it. I didn't, you know, and then obviously and it's a slow build. It doesn't, you know, we're not jumping into action for probably nearly an hour.
Yeah.
But there's just, firstly, she's an amazing character. She, you know, there's so much growth. That relationship with Newt is fantastic. You know, that maternal relationship. And then obviously we got Vasquez as well, who's just, you know, you're just too bad. Yeah. You know, she's carrying around the biggest gun, the smart gun, and you know, which is, an old machine gun attached to a Steadicam harness. It's just in terms of like also mixing crazy old filmmaking techniques, you know, using back projection effectively, you know, by just filling the frame and making it not look horrific it's an incredible. I watched it with my son. He's probably a bit young for it. He's 10 or maybe 9 when I showed it to him, and he was wearing a Fitbit. At one point, he checked his pulse. He's like, "Daddy, my pulse is 165. I was like, "I'm crossed. Is this bad parenting? Working. Is this bad parenting or really good parenting?" I'm not going to answer that question. I think it's good parenting. But it was so exciting to show it to, you know, that, and it's so tense, and it's such an amazing build. And those characters are all so iconic. And I sort of feel it's one of those films that's influenced video games, action. Like, there's name a sci-fi video game that hasn't pulled from Aliens. It's just, you know, everything. Whether it's, you know, I mean, it's huge, and it's, I don't know, it's a complete masterpiece, really. And I just think the script, it's one of those amazing scripts. It's an incredible lead character. You know, when she's going down in the elevator, you're American, so I won't say lift. She's going on the elevator, strapping a flamethrower to a pulse rifle. You're just like, Jesus, couldn't cinema get any better? I mean, it's also a film I've never watched in the cinema, which is kind of heartbreaking. So I'm going to have to remedy that. I'm going to, yeah, I have to find a cinema that's showing it. I mean, there's a 4K release coming out, so maybe someone's going to put it out in the cinema. I hope so, anyway. That'd be super cool.
Yeah, I think it's out like any day now.
It's kind of an obvious choice, but for me, it was so inspiring. And I'm sure it's one of the films that sort of made me want to make films. And I think just James Cameron he used to write such strong, cool female protagonists. And no one would bat an eyelid then, you know. They were just like, and nowadays, you know, just all this crappy talk about woke or whatever and this. But back then, people just accepted it and were like, oh, yeah, this is awesome.
One of the best sequels of all time.
Yes, I think Godfather Part 2. I mean, what else is there? I think
Terminator 2, another Cameron.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, God, he does do sequels, doesn't he? Yeah, yeah.
He does.
He's not bad at a sequel, yeah.
Ripley was, an obvious one, but to have it at the top of your list, I mean, where else could it go?
I just couldn't not. I sort of toyed with trying to, you know, find something a bit less, you know, like you said, a slightly more deep cut. I was thinking of Gloria or something like that, but I can't help myself. This is one of my favorites. And I watch this twice a year and have done every year since I was 10 years old, 11, 12 years old.
Well, highly worthy of a number one spot. Amazing. Will, great list. Let's recap our list for the listeners. And I will go first here. At number 5, I had Eleanor from To Catch a Killer. At number four, I had Cynthia Rothrock in the movie China O'Brien. At number three, I had Mulan from 1998. At number two, I had Angela Mao in the film Hapkido from 1972. And at number one, Pam Grier's role as Foxy Brown from 1974.
Very nice. So yeah, number five, I've got 1996, The Long Kiss Goodnight. That's Samantha Cain, Charlie Baltimore. I've got Out of Sight, 1998, the character Karen Sisko. Then we've got Marge Gunderson, Fargo, 1996. We've got Lola from 1999, Run Lola Run came out in England. I think 98 maybe in Germany, but Franco Potenza's Lola. And then number one, Ellen Ripley, Aliens. Yeah, like you said, one of the best sequels ever made. One of the best horror action film, one of the best sort of, yeah, it's just a flawless piece of incredible writing and direction. And interesting, actually some of the best making of material I've ever encountered. I remember I had the double disc DVD, now I've got the double disc Blu-ray, and the second it comes out in 4K, I'll buy it. This is another one I've bought a stupid amount of times, and I'll keep buying it. but some of the stuff, well, you look behind the scenes there, obviously well pre the CGI era. I'm a massive fan of visual effects. I'm not one of those guys who's an apologist that thinks everything should be practical. But looking back at how they did some of the stuff they did on that, you're open mouthed at this just sort of audacity and just vision and smart that they were like, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to reverse the film here. You know, and everyone's like, oh, you can't reverse the film. It's raining. And James Cameron's like, no one's going to notice the rain going up or down. It will just be movement in the frame. And you look at the big explosion at the end. It's just a big load of the planet LV-426 exploding. It's just, they're almost shining a light through cotton wool. And it's a really good, there's maybe 2 hours of making of footage on that that is just so inspired that you've just never been so sure of James Cameron's genius. And I don't use that word lightly, but he really was a super smart guy.
Like film school in a box.
Completely. Yeah. It really was. Because it's happening less and less now. We're sort of getting 5-minute puff pieces, aren't we? Maybe DVD or a Blu-ray if you're lucky. And it's just, you know, the director's commentaries are becoming less and less. So I think we've sort of, you know, our time of great behind the scenes material is definitely sort of falling off a cliff. But while it lasted, God, it really was. I didn't go to film school, but for me, that was just, you know, I mean, the amount of discs I've bought, not because I want to watch the film, but just because I've heard it's got amazing behind the scenes stuff, or, you know.
All right. Well, hey, we could only put five each on our list. Did you have any honorable mentions of films that maybe you would have put on if it was like a top 10?
Oh, I'm just, give me a minute. I've lost my list. Oh, 1 second. I had a couple. Well, I almost put Sicario on there because I think Emily Blunt is super cool in that. Mm-hmm. I had a moment when I just sat down maybe a year ago and just watched three films back to back, completely unrelated, but obviously not. I watched Sicario, I watched A Quiet Place, and then I watched Edge of Tomorrow, and I was just like, I didn't mean to put them on back to. I was just like, Emily Blunt is awesome. So it's sort of Sicario and Gloria. The John Cassavetes Gloria were one of my outliers. I only watched that maybe 2 years ago for the first time.
I haven't seen that
it's
one.
Just that, it's really cool. Really cool. It's kind of almost like Leon, but flipped. It's the girlfriend of like a sort of low level mafioso looking after this kid, and she doesn't give a shit about him. And then she's just tough as she starts pulling out the revolver, and yeah.
Well, shit, you had me at Leon. And
yeah. It's a really cool film. Actually, really good. Loved it.
All right.
So those are my awesome. Sicario, Gloria are my ones that I was sort of umming and ahhing about. Yeah.
Well, there's one for my list, Gloria.
Nice. Yeah, cool. Check it out.
A couple of honorable mentions for me, Furiosa from Mad Max Fury Road, which...
I'm sorry, that was my other one, but I thought you were going to do that because I thought who wouldn't do that, right? So I was convinced that, you know, but yeah, incredible character.
Yeah. When we talk about great female agents, Dana Scully from the X-Files movie could have been on my list. Aaron Brockovich was one that I considered. Elle Woods from Legally Blonde is a badass. Annie from RoboCop, I think, is a badass. And
she certainly is, yeah.
One that kind of adjacent to Jericho Ridge is Valerie in the movie Cop Shop by Joe Carnahan. If you haven't seen Cop Shop, it's a lot of fun. It's kind of a siege movie.
I have watched it. It was one of those ones which, as I was writing this, I read Oh, there's another film set in a police station, and I just thought, oh God, they're doing the exact same thing, and I'm going to have to.
Very
Do you know
different.
what I mean? But what I've realized is, no matter what you're doing, there's something that sounds exactly the same being developed alongside you, either in a much bigger, and it's never the same. But yeah, that was a cool. I enjoyed that. What's that? Frank Grillo and Jerry Butler as well, isn't it?
All right, well, listeners, you got more than 10 amazing films with badass female protagonists. And if you want another one to add to your list, you got to go check out Jericho Ridge. Holy shit. It's an amazing movie. You can find it in the U.S. on BET+. You'll be able to find it elsewhere soon. I will be posting about it when it does come out. Will, you got to post about it so I can see it and I'll repost it.
Absolutely. I will hit you up the second I have more news. But yeah. Jason, thanks so much for having me, and thanks so much for reaching out. And I'm just so glad you love the film. It's just so not, you know, it's super cool to hear good reactions.
Any plans for a Blu-ray physical release of Jericho Ridge?
Possible. This is like possibly not in the UK. I'm hoping Germany, the Germans tend to go quite... They're quite good on physical media, so I'm hoping. My brother did a film a year or two ago, which had a mostly digital release, and then I imported a 4K disc from Germany. But the Australians, nice. I'm hoping Australia or Germany take one for the team here and release it on physical media, because I would love to have this one on the shelf.
Yeah, I'll be first in line for that. Anything else you want to plug? Like send people to a page? Anything you got upcoming that you're excited about?
No, not at the moment. Just go. Just keep your eyes peeled for Jericho Ridge, please, and watch it and let me know what you think within reason on Twitter or Instagram.
Well, it's a great film. I don't think anybody's gonna be giving you bad feedback on Jericho Ridge. List nerds, thank you for joining us on this episode of Force 5. I want to thank Will one more time, and I'd also like to recommend Jericho Ridge again. I'm dead serious. This film is badass, it's fun, and who knows, maybe Deputy Tabby Temple makes her way into your top 5 badass female protagonists. If you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it, you can let me know by rating and reviewing the Force 5 podcast wherever you're listening. It does a lot for the show, and it lets me know that you like what I'm doing. Message me on Twitter at Force5Pod or email me at Force5Podcast@gmail.com and let me know who your favorite badass female protagonists are, and your choices may make next week's mini-episode. Intro and outro bumpers today come courtesy of Nate Spears. The top 5 list bumper was produced by me with music from Audio Binger. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, and go watch Jericho Ridge.